Welcome to History 101, Lecture 15, The World Trade Created. Besides the Age of Enlightenment, people in the 18th century also cherished their own age as the Age of Commerce. For instance, Thomas Parnell argued in 1764 that in the first age, the age of uncultured man, that meant the Greeks and the Roman periods, the power of the sword and the blind quest for glory were typical of society. In the second age, the Middle Ages, men with more leisure had turned their mind to spiritual matters. It was that which in that age made and unmade kingdoms. While in the present, the Third Age, starting with the discoveries, the spirit of commerce now ruled the powers of Europe. And the spirit of commerce would form a great commercial interest that would in due time unite all of those powers of Europe, nay, all the powers worldwide, if they would merely perceive that commerce was for everybody one general composite interest, as he put it. For each different site produces some special source of supply that is destitute in others, as Parnell put it. So that, for example, Africa had a comparative advantage, a word first used by economist David Ricardo in the 19th century, but that is what Parnell meant, as a producer of slaves. So it might then favorably procure other goods from elsewhere. Well, Parnell hoped too that India, that had so far, alas, purchased few European goods, could after Buxar be taught it should purchase more European goods too, although it admittedly only purchased still a few, mainly iron. As all areas thus needed one another, commerce was a natural force of attraction, and if states only would be as wise as to see that all commercial interests were united, and they would not try to advance their own interest by tariff walls or prohibitions on trade, then humanity would inexorably advance towards peace and prosperity, as states would henceforth not compete with one another by war, as rather by trade. I'm pretty sure Thomas Friedman, in preparing his Lexus and the Olive Tree, did not read Parnell, but it is, of course, the very same argument he made 230 years later. Friedman argued that two countries that both had a branch of McDonald's would never go to war with one another. And so too, Parnell would likely have argued that two countries that both boasted slaves from Africa would never go to war with one another. And yet it must immediately be granted to Parnell that the 18th century was indeed the age of commerce. For, on the one hand, capitalism was creating its own demand. As Voltaire said, for example, the East India Company was not needed in the early 17th century. 10 times less spices were then consumed than presently. Coffee, tea, Chinese haberdasheries were all unknown, and textiles were not procured from India. And we have only our own greed and need to blame for that. Louis XIV never said to our Frenchmen, "I will hereby command you to put 4,500,000 livres worth annually of snuff in your noses, and you will procure this from Virginia." And Louis XIV never said, "I will hereby command every citizen to wear beautiful muslims and clothes woven on the bank of the Ganges." Sugar, coffee, tea, Indian textiles, tobacco, or cocoa were all new products. Products for which a demand was essentially created in Europe, partly by relentless plucking of the East India companies, partly too by merchants that sought a niche market, as with coffee, originally a plant from Ethiopia, and the use of which was partly pioneered by merchants returning from Turkey, and partly by Armenian merchants residing in Europe, who pioneered the coffee house or the café. The café had become, by 1700, an indispensable part of bourgeois culture and of the whole public sphere of the Enlightenment, as we have seen already. And the use of coffee then was being spread downward by itinerant coffee vendors to the working classes, so that by 1720 it was complained no seamstress in Holland would even think of starting to work before first having drunk a cup of coffee. And on the other hand, the 18th century witnessed the apotheosis of a peculiar kind of capitalism, merchant capitalism, in which capitalism was still mostly confined to the sphere of speculation in money or in products, and to arbitrage, as economists call it, that is, bringing products from one place to another place, for the replacement of one mode of production by another, as Marxists call it, that is, from feudalism, whatever that may be, to capitalism, is a very slow process that gradually took shape over many centuries. It started somewhere in the 13th or even the 11th century, and it was still not completed by the 20th century, as regional monographs of historians have come to pour in on France, and indeed on Europe. It all looks ever more archaic, to paraphrase historian Robert Danton on the 18th century. And it must be added to that as well, that historians have tended to focus on the most developed parts of Europe. We know infinitely more about France than we do about Albania. And in France, in addition, we know least about its poorest parts, as for example about Corsica. To be sure, from 1500 onwards, the urban bourgeoisie had steadily been buying more land. And by 1700, huge tracts of land everywhere in Europe belonged to absentee landlords from the cities, who either received quit rents from the peasants or used a system of sharecropping. That means a landlord allows a peasant the use of his land, but receives part of his produce. In Italy, the fulcrum of European capitalism up to the 17th century, indeed, this system goes back to the 14th century. It was there called mezzadria. Peasants had to work for landowners resident in the cities. And the landlords owned the land and provided the peasants with housing, cattle, plow, and other equipment. The peasant would then sign a contract. He would yield half his crop to the landlord. Such a contract was commonly renewed every year, and the landlord was in principle permitted to throw peasants off their land, though in practice that almost never happened. By the 15th century, most of Tuscany's countryside was already owned by merchants resident in Florence, such as, for example, the well-studied village of Valpolicella, that was acquired by the major Capponi banking family in the 16th century. Valpolicella was run by an estate manager from its castle, and it was indeed a very close-run estate. It very much approached a plantation. Everybody, down to the village priest, was named by the estate manager, and part of the estate was used for food, crops, for the peasants' own use, and part was used for cultivating the famous Valpolicella Chianti, wine that was and is still sold all over Europe. The estate manager had then yearly to hand his books to the Capponi to check whether the profits of the estates were sufficient. An almost completely capitalist system. Again, in the Lombardy countryside, both the bourgeoisie and the church owned vast estates. In that case, they run it themselves. The landlords ran their own estate, and they hired labor for it. A system that also at least goes back to the 15th century, and that expanded throughout the 16th and 17th centuries. As I said already, in the Italian case, such rural capitalism was obviously closely linked to demand from Italy's huge cities. Yet, as I said already too, Italian capitalism to an extent also retreated into safe investments in the countryside when the economic environment became ever less favorable in the 17th century. Yet, in contrast, the south of Italy was steadily slipping further back into feudalism as the hold of feudal courts over the countryside was tightened and the peasant life burdened by restrictions on grazing cattle, on gathering chestnuts, and so on. By 1700, 75% in the Kingdom of Naples that covered the Italian south was owned by feudal estate owners, while first the Spaniards and then the subsequent Bourbon dynasty bestowed ever more titles on the nobility to buy support. In 1590, there were 100 barons in Naples. 200 years later, there were 300. So the saying in Italy became, "You're looking for nobility? Go to Naples. You're looking for religion? Go to Rome. If you're looking for beauty, go to Milan. If you look for politics, go to Florence. And if you're looking for riches, go to Venice." Again, Spain's Andalusia was from its very conquest in the 15th century onward dominated by great noble estates. Partly, as in the 15th century, the Muslim small peasants had been divided amongst the Christian conquerors. But partly too, because conquistadors, returning from the Americas, had everywhere bought lands and titles there. And they accumulated ever more landed property from their remittances from the Americas or from fighting goods on the Indies-bound fleets. For, though officially this was completely below the dignity of a Spanish hidalgo, by the 17th century they still extensively engaged in trade. Although Andalusia was hit, and badly hit, by the expulsion of the Moriscos, the converted Muslims, in 1580, that the Muslim irrigation systems in Andalusia gradually went to waste was still primarily due to the landlords trying to make the whole of the province into a wine-growing monoculture and the monoculture of other products, such as olives, that commanded a ready market in the Americas, and they grew as little grain as possible. A very similar structure existed in the Algarve and in the Alentejo in Portugal too. These areas too were dominated by trading nobles and landlords. They would invest all kinds of agrarian revenues in the India and in the Brazil trade, and with that they bought all kinds of feudal titles and revenues in turn. Indeed, one reason why Portugal and Spain both had a relatively weak bourgeoisie was because the bourgeoisie was gradually elbowed aside by trading nobles. And two, because merchant families tried to secure safe positions for their sons as judges or lawyers in a burgeoning bureaucracy in both countries. Countries that had, after all, not merely to administer Spain or Portugal, but their vast colonies as well. Madrid, in the 18th century, with 400,000 people, one of Europe's largest cities, in particular, produced little but paper and goods for conspicuous consumption, while Spain's bourgeoisie was typically found in Barcelona rather than in parasitic Madrid. as the Catalonia region went through a remarkable economic renaissance in the 18th century. A renaissance partly built on booming manufacturing, partly built on shipping, and partly built on agriculture, dominated by small tenant farmers, whereas Andalusia, with its landlords, slipped steadily more in decay. A very similar process was taking place in Portugal, where the Algarve and the Alentejo were ever more neglected by their landlords, whereas the tenant farmer region of the Douro, in the north, was profiting from booming demand for port wine in England. And the new bourgeoisie of Oporto, enriched by that wine trade, increasingly saw that court, that bureaucracy, and those idling nobles of Lisbon as parasites and as competitors. The civil war that ravaged Portugal in the 1820s between the liberals and the absolutists was pretty much a struggle of liberal Porto against absolutist Lisbon. However, though capitalism was definitely making inroads into the countryside, most of the European countryside was still dominated by peasant masses. Peasant masses who primarily produced to satisfy their own needs, and secondarily for selling a few goods in the cities for paying their taxes. It was a vast rural ocean on which capitalism still constantly floundered on the sandbanks of peasant resistance, of peasant uses, or of peasant obstruction. Yet, as the urban bourgeoisie was acquiring ever more land, peasants were pushed back into ever smaller pieces of land. Thus, in France in 1700, the nobility owned about 20% of all the land. The urban bourgeoisie owned 15% and the church owned 5%. That is, 2 million persons owned 40% of all the land, 19 million peasants the rest, so that in large parts of France, peasants were pushed back into holdings that were too minuscule to maintain a family, and often not even a single peasant. In a very archetypical case of La France Profonde, the province of Beauvais, half the peasants owned insufficient land to maintain themselves, while agrarian productivity there was in the 18th century actually lower than it had been in the 13th. Yet peasants were under no circumstance willing to forsake their land, as the possession of land alone gave somebody dignity. It is only by this process that we can understand the great rural revolt, Le Grand Peur, that struck France in the year of the Revolution, 1789, and that Grand Peur in turn radicalized the new assembly that was convening in Paris. The most radical measure of the Revolution, the abolition of feudalism on the critical date of 4 August 1789, would not have taken place without the peasants already torching the chateau of the nobles. I ought to add to that, that areas where peasants more or less managed to subsist on their own property, and that spotted few great landlords, such as the Vendée on the Atlantic coast, became royalist bulwarks during the Revolution. Similarly, capitalism had only scratched the surface of production. There were, to be sure, a few major industrial enterprises in the early 18th century that employed hundreds, sometimes thousands of laborers. The state-run Phoenician arsenal is one of the biggest and one of the oldest. It goes back to the 13th century. To that were joined, in the 17th century, the shipbuilding sites on the Zaan, near Amsterdam, where ships could be assembled in a few weeks. And wood, imported from Norway and the Baltic, was sown by windmills in standardized measures and sizes. The Zaan employed at least 5,000 laborers. There were too the Tilbury dockyards in England, or there were the Saint-Gobain glassworks that made glass used for mirrors. Saint-Gobain employed some 2,000 workers, and it was a darling of Colbert's attempt to found state-run factories in France, a cornerstone of the mercantilist policy we have been discussing in an earlier lecture. Actually, Saint-Gobain still exists, and it is world's largest producer of glass. The solar panels used in the International Space Station were produced by Saint-Gobain. Following Colbert's example, in the 18th century, princes throughout Europe tried to put up factories, such as, for example, the Royal Factory of Porcelain. The Elector of Saxony put up in the town of Meissen in 1723. That's another state company that still exists, and that has grown into a huge multinational as well. Or again, the large textile factory that Empress Maria Theresa put up at Linz in Austria in 1768. Nowadays, it is called Linz Textil, and it's one of the world's main manufacturers of yarn. And then, there was still the most famous of them all, the Real Fabrica de Tabacos. The Spanish king put up in Seville in 1758, and with which most listeners ought to be familiar, as Carmen worked there, and who hasn't seen that opera. This is another company that still exists. It produces the major tobacco brands Colois and Gitane. And France without Colois is unimaginable. It is commonly argued by economic historians, with all their inevitable neoliberal slants, that the state-assisted enterprises of the mercantilist era were all failures. But there are many examples to the contrary. State-run enterprises that have prospered for 3 centuries. Yet, such big plans were very much the exception. On the one hand, most manufacturing in the cities was still dominated by the guild system and by the artisans, who made up a very major part of the urban population. In some cities, more than half the population were artisans, and they made a bewildering array of products. In the bigger cities, sometimes more than 900 different crafts are recorded, including such long-disappeared ones as coach-making, wig-making, and candle-making. Some of these workshops were quite big. Most employed only a few people. They were ranged from apprentices at the top, who were taught a particular craft, and commonly lived with their master, journeymen, who had some skills, and often a fixed employee in the workshop, but were not living with their masters, and hired hands. Journeymen were quite a mobile group. They constantly shifted employers, and they often moved from one city to another. In fact, an indispensable part of the German folklore are still the so-called Wanderlieder, originally sung by moving apprentices. At the top came the masters. The masters had to perform a masterpiece that was judged by a jury of masters. This then allowed the master entrance to a guild. He had to swear he was to abide by its regulations, he had to pay membership fees, and he would then be allowed to establish his own workshop. The master of a workshop was responsible for acquiring raw materials, for hiring workers, and for setting the price of his products. Now, this entire guild-like setup has by no means disappeared nowadays. And how to perceive the artisans and masters as a class is very dependent on how you now would rate, say, hotel owners, barkeepers, opticians, hairdressers, or garage owners. The lowest of them are undoubtedly part of the working class. However, somebody who owns, say, 2 hairdressing saloons that employ 5 people would nowadays typically be called lower middle class. In the 18th century, a master who was a member of a guild would have rated himself part of the respectable people, who stood several steps above unskilled workers. And he was also, to that extent, not working class. As a master, was at liberty to decide at what time he was going to go to work, or how his workday would look like. And obviously, many a common white-collar employee nowadays, even if employed in management, would have loved to change places with him. However, a master was definitely not part of the bourgeoisie, and in urban riots and revolts, and, as we shall see later, even in the 19th century workers' movements, the masters commonly acted as spokesmen of the common people, as was the case for the most radical element of the French Revolution, the Paris sans-culottes, those without breeches. The sans-culottes were basically led by masters, and they were mostly recruited from the apprentices. For, as I said in the previous lecture, Paris was France's, indeed one of the world's main, centers for the production of luxury goods that were focused on small workshops, and Paris featured a particularly proud working class. A working class that was proud on its skills and on its long tradition that ranged back to the 14th century. There were, in addition, two more things that made Paris to a potential powder keg. First, Paris was extremely densely populated, and that made Paris so dangerous, the very, very rich lived in Paris cheek to jowl with the very poor. As in Louis XIV's time, provincial nobles had moved into hotels, which then meant stately residences in Paris. Now, Paris shared these characteristics with Genoa and with Naples. But in those two cities, and in the last one in particular, tensions were somewhat diffused as local churches and monastic orders clued neighborhoods together. In Paris, however, the working classes had become increasingly skeptical and increasingly uneasy with the church. It was je m'en fousism, as it's called in French, of all organized religion. Indeed, they were to retain that attitude throughout the 19th century. And this for practically the very same reasons as why Boccaccio had been critical of the church before. The church was to them patently an avenue for clergymen to get rich and an instrument of the ruling classes. On the other hand, particularly during the bad economic times of the 17th century, as manufacturing was too expensive or too much hampered by count regulations, manufacturing was increasingly shifted to the countryside. This was called the putting out, German Verlag system, in which merchants handed either raw materials or loans to peasants, who would then work those materials to finished products. They were commonly paid piece rates for finished products once the merchants collected. Now, in the 18th century, such rural manufacturing sprang up in many different places, and it often catered for quite remote markets. For example, one reason why Frederick II wanted so much to obtain Silesia was as it was one of the main centers of textile manufacturing in Germany. Some 40,000 families in Silesia depended on the weaving of textiles, and Silesian textiles were exported to Russia and to South America. Again, by 1780, Bohemia sported a huge manufacturing industry in which an estimated 100,000 people worked, one-tenth of its entire population, and that exported primarily to Russia. Or finally, in the 18th century, a major export of rural Ireland became coarse linen cloth, and particularly rural Ulster, present Northern Ireland, that was traditionally a flax-growing region, came to depend on it. Most of that was called Osnaburg, originally named of the German town of Osnabrück. And that cloth was by and large meant for clothing slaves on plantations. And Osnabrück was distributed among the slaves at the beginning of the Middle Passage across the Atlantic. Now historians have long discussed two issues regarding this putting out system. First, the extent to which it was a so-called proto-industrial stage. That is, it would eventually lead to production in factories. The best answer here seems to be that the results were a bit mixed. In some cases, proto-industrialization was a blind alley. It led nowhere. In the three cases just mentioned, it led, though through a very winding and torturous road, eventually to industrialization. Silesia was up to the 1950s the most heavily industrialized part of Poland, and its capital, Wrocław, formerly Breslau, is indeed still one of Europe's great industrial cities. Bohemia was the earliest and most heavily industrialized part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, while finally Ulster eventually became the only industrialized part of Ireland. I will return to this issue in a later lecture. Second, there has been a lot of argument on whether proto-industrialization was a major step in the advancement of capitalist relations of production, as it obviously made rural producers entirely dependent on putting out merchants, who in turn sold their goods to distant markets. Indeed, conditions in such village industries were bad, often worse than in factories. While often, peasants were their entire life in debt to those putting out merchants as well. And yet, as historian William Reddy describes the French textile industry, across the entire spectrum of organizational structures that flourished during the putting out phase of textile production, entrepreneurial control always remained lodged, not with the possessor of accumulated capital, but elsewhere, either with guild institutions or with the humble cottager himself. The humble cottager controlled the pace, application, care, timing, and sometimes even the technique of his work, while merchants still had so little control over the production process that it was reasonable for them to regard cloth as the outcome of a mysterious folk wisdom, as uncertain and as unpredictable in its own way as the subtle marriage of fine, soil and climate in the production of wine. There is a record of one case in which a Rouen merchant put out words to have cotton handkerchiefs produced in square instead of rectangular dimensions. 2 years later, he was still receiving rectangular from the countryside. Furthermore, many of those putting out merchants were actually peasants, who had made some particularly advantageous deals. In other words, capitalism was definitely advancing by comparison with the 16th century, but it had neither penetrated production nor agriculture very deeply and remained still largely confined to trade. Besides which, anything but trade was seen by the capitalists themselves as degrading. In the Bible for Merchants of the 17th and 18th century, Le Parfait Négociant, that was 14 times reprinted, it was remarked that the marchand en gros, who did not make anything, but traded everything, were, of course, the best group of merchants, since they did not have to debase themselves by doing manual labor. And even when it came to trade, there was still a difference between what historian Stephen Kaplan calls the market principle, that is the principle of the ideal free markets, where humans might freely engage in their natural propensity to truck and barter, as Adam Smith classically put it, a few increasingly embraced by the authorities and urged upon the authorities by those engaged in political arithmetics, as economics was then called, such as Smith or Quesnay, and on the other hand, there was the marketplace. The marketplace was closely overseen by the authorities, both to forestall unrest, or for that matter even seditious talk, and to enforce anti-monopoly legislation. For if there was one thing which was likely to lead to rioting in the cities, it was monopoly. Yet that marketplace really included virtually any basic commodity, fish or flour and so on. For the provisioning of big and provincial cities was too delicate a matter to be left to the market principle or to the free market. Now, the great Hungarian economist Karl Polanyi has in his seminal The Great Transformation contended that the modern market economy and the modern nation-state should be understood not as discrete elements, but as a single human invention that he calls market society. Prior to the Great Transformation, according to Polanyi, people based their economies on reciprocity and redistribution, and they were not rational utility maximizers. After the Great Transformation, people became more economically rational. They behaved as neoclassical economic theory would have predicted. The creation of capitalist institutions not merely changed laws, but also fundamentally altered humankind's economic mentalities, such that prior to the Great Transformation, markets played a very minor role in human affairs and were not even capable of setting prices because of their diminutive size. And it was only after the creation of new market institutions that the myth of humanity's propensity to barter and trade became widespread orthodoxy, an effort to mold human nature to fit new market-based economic institutions. Fundamentally, in my view, Polanyi was right, though, admittedly, he was mistaking a process that took centuries for one that was suddenly introduced in the beginning of the 19th century. And above all, he was mistaking a process that was fundamentally embedded within class structures as one imposed from above. So what kind of world did capitalist trade create in the 17th and 18th centuries? Well, first of all, there was a lot more of it than in the 16th century. British export, for example, increased from 2 million sterling in 1620 to 4 million in the 1660s, to 6.9 million in 1720, to 14.7 in 1770, and to 17 in 1709. Imports increased from about 3 in 1660, to 6.1 in 1720, to 12.2 in 1770, and to 17.4 in 1790, while shipping tonnage increased from 340,000 in 1680 to 752,000 in 1786. And though most ships and most sailors were obviously always involved in trade within Europe, that rapid increase was primarily due to increasing trade with the colonies. For example, in London in 1790, voyages within Europe accounted for nearly half the total tonnage of London's trade. India accounted only for 8% and the West Indies for 20%. However, trade in Europe made up 32% of the total value of trade. India 28% and the West Indies 31%. As it so nicely dovetails with Karl Marx's position that capital needed for the development of industrial capitalism, what he called primitive accumulation, derived primarily from the plunder of the colonies, a whole drove of economists have been at pains to stress that the colonial periphery was peripheral to European economies, a position that has some validity for the 16th century, and, as we shall see, has some validity for the late 19th century too, but for no period is it so little true as for the 18th century, nor in fact is it true for the period of the Industrial Revolution itself. Now, part of that growth was caused by old areas of colonial trade that were still prospering. Thus, for example, the very traditional monopoly trade with the Indies. The only thing which happened there was that it was moved from Seville to Cadiz in 1694. Both because the Guadalquivir River that flows through Seville was getting too shallow, as because Cadiz, on its peninsula, was much better defensible than Seville. There was an exponential increase in that trade in the 18th century. In fact, and rightly, it was at the turn of the 17th century still described as the richest trade of all of Europe. The number of ships that crossed the Atlantic to Panama rose from 30 in 1710 to 100 in 1770, with a corresponding increase in the size of the ships. Furthermore, more or less corresponding to complaints of the other Spanish provinces that the Indies trade had been abused to serve as milk cow of Andalusia previously, the Spanish crown chartered in the course of the 18th century a number of separate provincial companies. Thus, for example, Posca, and as nobody but Basque can pronounce that word, it is generally called the Caracas Company, that was to develop trade between Bilbao, main city of the Basque country, and Cartagena in Colombia. And that company obtained a monopoly on all trade of Venezuela. In the 16th century, Venezuela was a struggling small settlement with merely a few thousand inhabitants. But by the late 17th century, migrants from the Basque country and from the Canary Islands began to lay out slave-run plantations there that grew coca for a rapidly increasing market in Europe. After all, in the polite company of the Paris Salon, the ladies were to drink chocolate and the men drank coffee. Other examples were the less successful Royal Company of Havana, that was to develop yet another neglected piece of real estate of the Spanish crown, Cuba, and finally the Royal Company of Barcelona, that was to trade with yet another neglected area, Hispaniola, or the present Dominican Republic, and Puerto Rico. All these areas had conducted most of their trade so far with the Dutch. In fact, the Dutch had settled on the island of Curaçao, directly off the coast of Venezuela, to trade with the Spanish colonies. So, the capital of Venezuela, Caracas, featured by 1800 a rich bourgeoisie. A rich bourgeoisie that was not really that dependent on Spain, as its produce was sold all over Europe, and as it could be exported via Curaçao as well. One example of them were the very rich and traditionally Basque family Bolivar planters. They were that rich, in fact, that they could even afford to buy a patent to become nobles. We shall have a lot more to say about their eldest son, Simon, in the next lecture. However, the trade of the Americas was primarily, as before, driven by silver. Potosí output had dropped in the middle of the 17th century, but in the 18th century, new mines were being discovered in Mexico. The mines in Guanajuato, 200 kilometers north of Mexico City, were generally considered the richest mines in the world in the 18th century. They delivered in total 2.5 million pounds of silver. Unlike in Potosí, the Mexican mines were small vertical shaft mines that were found all over the country. By the mid-18th century, there were at least 3,000 mining pits all over Mexico. The smallest only employed 4 or 6 people, the biggest were enormous firms employing thousands and that had capitals in the millions of pesos. At the beginning of the silver boom, mines were still allotted Indian workers, but by 1720, workers were hired and received a share in the revenue of the mines. Where was all that silver exported to? Well, Alexander von Humboldt, in the beginning of the 19th century, estimated that Europe annually received $43 million, that is reales de ocho, in precious metals from the Americas. 4 million were exported to the Ottoman Empire, 17.5 million, that's nearly half, via the Cape, and 9 million went to China via the Cape, and another 4 million were exported to China via Siberia. Furthermore, new areas of trade had been opened up. Most obviously, there were the new routes to the Caribbean and to West Africa. I dealt with them in an earlier lecture. And that entire complex in the Atlantic was by 1740 in many ways the mainstay of global trade. And then there was obviously North America, the exports of which to Britain increased from 0.2 million sterling in 1700 to about 2.3 in 1760. Now in the 18th century, European governments systematically tried to further the frontiers of trade and empire to include the yet little known hinterland of South America, or in a rather anarchic way of South Africa, by a new device that most usefully linked several things. The scientific expedition. Such scientific expeditions no doubt usefully served to expand the frontiers of science, yet they were equally meant to scout for useful plants that might be profitably cultivated elsewhere, the most famous case of which was the 1780 voyage of His Majesty's ship Bounty, that was to fetch breadfruit from Tahiti to plant in the West Indies. Very commonly too, such expeditions were intended to stake claims on territory before some rival might claim it. The expeditions were to scout for exploitable minerals, and last but not least, they were either to search potentially exploitable new regions or search some way to bypass rival colonial empires. The whole thing was, for example, unified in the person of Alexander Dalrymple. Dalrymple was half a geographer, half a cartographer, and he was widely rumored to be an expert on the geography of the South Seas. And yet, he was half a smuggler too, who was trying to circumvent the monopoly of the Dutch East India Company on navigation in the eastern part of the Indonesian archipelago. Very similar, and often quite conflicting motives, drove the voyages of exploration in the South Sea, the great epic of the 18th century. These were organized by several European governments, such as, for example, the two voyages of Danish captain Vitus Bering. One to explore the Kamchatka Peninsula in 1727, and the second one to explore a possible land bridge between the Americas and Asia in 1740, during which he discovered the Aleutian Islands. For the some 3,000 inhabitants of the Aleutians, their first contact with civilization proved a mixed blessing, as in 1748 the islands were occupied by a particularly nasty band of Promisleniki. They enslaved the entire population of the island, they shot any man who wasn't willing to work for them, so that the men henceforth had to go hunting for seals while they dallied with their women. By 1800 there was practically nobody left on the Aleutians, but there was still a small settlement of Russian fur. However, as Spanish, British and even the French government were also beginning to show interest in the desolate area of Alaska, Omsk fur trader Grigory Seligov persuaded Catherine the Great to establish a company for the exploration Alaska. It established a settlement on Kodiak Island in 1792. As the Russians had then to rapidly occupy Alaska, as they were suffering from cutthroat competition from New England fur traders, that company was transformed into the Russia-America Company in 1800, and it founded the first settlement on mainland Alaska, Sitka, in 1802. The Russians led a dreary existence there. Their life was filled by boredom and by worries about their food. It had, after all, to be shipped all the way from St. Petersburg. But then, fortunately, they had the balalaika, so they spent a lot of time singing and dancing, and in their parties the local Tlingit tribesmen joined commonly too. By the 1770s, the exploration of the Pacific led to a kind of scramble in miniature between Britain and France, who could explore the Pacific first. Such expeditions partly served, no doubt, to further scientific knowledge. So the ships of Captain James Cook, during his 3 voyages to explore the Pacific from 1768 to 1771, from 1772 to 1775, and from 1776 to 1779, were accurately described as floating laboratories. They took a whole crew of scientists along, with whom Cook, after dinner table, would discuss scientific matters. For Cook was a real gentleman captain. Similarly, the voyages of Louis-Antoine de Bougainville around the world. That voyage served scientific purposes, and it too had a load of scientists aboard, like the ship's botanist, Philippe Commercheron. Commercheron had a boy valet with him. Later on, he was unmasked by the ship's surgeon to be a lady, so she was thus the first woman to circumnavigate the globe. It was all very scientific, and yet Diderot had one old Tahitian remark in his review of Bougainville's report on his discoveries. Quote, Oru, you who speak the language of those people, say them this, how can they write on a piece of metal, this land is ours, this country is yours? And why? Because you have put foot on it? If one day a Tahitian landed on your land, and he would engrave on a tree, this land is now of Tahiti, what would you think of that? Yes, you are the strongest. And what does this do to you? When we take away one of those despicable trifles with which your ship is filled, you exclaim it, theft, and yet you want to steal our entire country. You say you are not a slave. You'd rather die than be a slave. But you do want to enslave us. End quote. That's in fact a pretty accurate description of what was eventually to await the Tahitians. Nowadays, they are a département of the Republic of France, and most inhabitants subsist on dole paid by France, in return for an allowance for France to use that island as a nuclear test site. However, the 18th century great windfall was Brazil. As I said in the previous lecture, the Bank of England's experiment with cash certificate would have floundered without the inflow of Brazilian gold. At this point, I will have to step back in time. In 1554, a Jesuit named Manuel de Nobrega had founded a mission post in an area that offered a few pastures in an otherwise densely forested region. He had called it São Paulo de Piratinga. Isolated by an escarpment from the coast with the sugar plantations, São Paulo became the refuge for both men from the coast and for the very worst criminals who were shipped off as convicts from Portugal. Frei Francisco de Montoya described these Paulistas as a bunch of rebels. They recognized neither king or law, and if the authorities searched for them, they would hide in the forest. By 1600, São Paulo had 2,000 inhabitants. They engaged in subsistence agriculture and a bit of cattle ranching. All of them were dirt poor, so they were clearly not all too attractive grooms for ladies from Portugal, so most of them had Indian wives, commonly several. In reality, the Paulistas were by 1600 virtually indistinguishable from Indians. The language used in São Paulo was Guarani rather than Portuguese. Now, these settlers had repeatedly to ward off Indian attacks. That was not that difficult, as they had firearms and the Indians at best had arrows. So in 1602, an expedition left under Nicolau Barreto, under the pretext, wrote one of the Jesuit friars, of searching for mines, but actually to capture and enslave Indians. That first expedition proved so successful that by 1630, wrote Montoya, everybody in Sao Paulo is now either treating in Indians or is searching for Indians. And they do that so greedily as if the Indians are gold mines. By the 1660s, those armed bands called prospectors or followers of the flag, banderantes, gradually fanned out over the entire vast and up to then largely unknown hinterland of Brazil, Paraná, Piauí, Goiás, right up to the Jesuit missions in Paraguay that were constantly under attack by banderante slave traders. Aside from which, as I mentioned already, banderante bands assisted in hunting down fugitive black slaves from the coast, and they destroyed the African kingdom of Palmares. Some of the captured slaves they sold onto plantations. Some of them they also sold in Sao Paulo itself, to be employed in agriculture there. So the banderantes particularly loved to prey on Indians in the crown-protected villages, to the great anger of Viceroy Antonio Gonçalves de Câmara Coutinho, who wrote of them, "They mislead the local government by saying they are going on a scouting expedition to look for gold, on my orders. In that way, they can obtain food and weapons, and they use these to take poor Indians of the villages captives." These men of Sao Paulo are really only outlaws, and they live in a village where nobody obeys the king or the law. The Brazilian appreciation of the banderantes is nowadays somewhat mixed. On the one hand, they most likely killed tens of thousands of Indians. On the other hand, though, the Portuguese had, by the famous Treaty of Tordesillas, in which the world was divided between Portugal and Spain, only obtained a tiny corner of land at the edge of Brazil. However, as Spain never, calling the Roman law that something becomes your property if you are the first to use it, claimed effective possession of most of the American continent, the Portuguese could, with their effective occupation by the banderantes, claim they had now an effective right to use vast swathes of the American continent. And the Spanish crown was finally, in the Treaty of Madrid in 1754, in return for the Portuguese recognizing the Spanish claim on the Colonia de Sacramento, present Montevideo, on the northern banks of the Rio de la Plata, brought to concede vast swathes of territory that were occupied by banderantes as Portuguese territory, effectually most of the area covered by modern Brazil. So, on the one hand, everybody knows that the banderantes likely killed tens of thousands, yet they are venerated in Brazil as well, as they effectively created the Brazilian country. Now, sometime around 1693, one more or less bona fide scouting expedition of banderantes found gold in the vicinity of the Vila Rica do Ouro Preto. And by 1695, reports were being received in the then capital of Brazil, Salvador de Bahia, that almost daily new veins of gold were being discovered in the rivers of a region that the Portuguese later on called the General Mines, Minas Gerais. And so in the next few years, as Jesuit Friar Antonio classically described it, countless people, foreigners and Portuguese, came out on the fleets, from the cities, from the plantations, and from the backlands of Brazil. There came whites, there came colored, there came blacks, together with the Amerindians that were employed by the polistas. There were men and women. They were young and old. They were poor and rich. They were nobles and commoners. They were laymen. They were clergy. And nobody had any house or convent in Brazil. The only law all these people observe is who gets to pen for gold where. And there are neither policemen nor judges to punish them for all their crimes. And there are many, especially homicide and theft. And as to the priests in Minas Gerais, they were like the children of Israel in the desert. Only by 1720 did the Portuguese crown manage to impose some order on those rowdy masses of coal diggers. Again, since all these people moved into a then densely forested region, there was initially almost no food for them, and a huge cost had to be fetched from distant Bahia via a tiny port of Paraty. Smart merchants soon enough realized there might be a market for food, so they cleared vast tracts of land in the typical Brazilian way, as it has remained to the present. That means setting forests on fire, and when the yields of the cultivated lands begin to drop, move on to other fields, but not allowing the forest to regrow, as rather giving the land over to cattle, so that land, in this Brazilian way, is permanently deforested. For all that work, both in deep mine shafts and in agriculture and in ranching, slaves were needed. But as the Portuguese crown tried to restrict slave trade to Lisbon alone, and restrict the number of slaves, the merchants of Rio de Janeiro saw a golden opportunity, and they started more or less illegally to outfit their own expeditions that carried Brazilian tobacco, spirits, and the ubiquitous Indian textiles that they obtained from the ships from Goa that habitually made a stop in Brazil. End quote. And they used that to bribe the Africa Company's personnel and that of the Dutch West India Company to sell slaves to them. Particularly the latter, by the mid-18th century, more or less subsisted on wheeling and dealing with cariocas, as the inhabitants of Rio de Janeiro were called. And the Brazilians turned to Angola. Angola sent out in the 18th century a record 1 million slaves. Yet Angola is not densely populated West Africa. It is mostly thinly populated savanna, so that the slaves had to be fetched over huge distances with corresponding severe loss of life. Basically, the interior of Angola was in the 18th century virtually emptied by the slave trade, as were parts of the Congo Basin. About 100,000 slaves were in that way sold to Minas Gerais. And Rio de Janeiro boomed with the mines too. From a rather sleepy little settlement of perhaps 10,000 people, it had around 1800, 90,000 people, the second largest city of the hemisphere after Mexico City, for the population of Potosí dwindled as the production of the mines there declined. By way of comparison, the largest city of North America, Philadelphia, had then only 40,000 people. Now, the value of that coal exported from Brazil was utterly staggering. It is estimated that the amount of coal imported from Brazil in the 1 year 1703 alone was worth the same as what Europe had imported from West Africa over the last 2 centuries. The total estimated gold imported from Brazil from 1700 to 1760 is valued at 850 tons, or about $1 billion at the then course. What happened to that gold once it was unloaded in Lisbon's Terreiro do Passo, the place of commerce that is shown in the illustration of this lecture? Well, a lot of it was sent on to the Mediterranean, to finance French and Phoenician trade to the Ottoman Empire, and it was shipped to Egypt in particular. However, by the Methuen Treaty of 1703, in which England and Portugal had agreed on mutual custom freedom, Portugal increasingly slipped into a relationship of dependency with England, as due to cheaper imports from England, much of the Portuguese manufacturing industry was wiped out, and Portugal, furthermore, came increasingly to depend on importing English and New England corn. By 1740, the English consul in Lisbon could write, "There is not a single English man of war, homeward bound from any point of the compass that does not take Lisbon in its way home. And everybody knows their only business here is taking money. Though Prime Minister Marques de Pombal tried to stem this flow of gold to Britain by establishing merchant companies and industrial enterprises, he still had to concede in 1755 that the English effectually ruled his country. This situation explains the decision of Queen Anne of England to establish a gold standard in the British colonies, and then the decision of Isaac Newton in 1717, who was then master of the Royal Mint, to fix a new mint ratio between silver and gold, a mint ratio that drove silver out of circulation or to India. It was just then witnessing a phenomenal import of silver. That standard effectually put Britain on a gold standard, a system the British, with their increasing hold on global banking, then brought other countries to confirm to, as we shall see in a later lecture. Yet still, a lot of that gold stayed in Portugal, and it was used by the crown to build, for example, the Gargantuan Palace Monastery of Mafra. By 1750, it was noted that Portugal had now really become a province of Brazil, and that the King of Portugal was really a King of Brazil who just happened to live in Portugal. Yet, this obviously caused a lot of anger in Brazil. For why was all Brazil's capital draining to Portugal to support that Mafra? Actually, the kings of Portugal never resided in Mafra, and they preferred their new out-residence of much smaller Canoes. Or why should Brazil support that entire top-heavy administration in Lisbon? Or for that matter, why should Brazil support Portuguese India, that in the 18th century dangled on subsidies from Brazil? As the Brazilian rhyme had it about all those haughty officials coming in from Portugal, Papagaio Real, fura para Portugal. Was it not better for Brazil to become independent and get rid of all those Portuguese parasites? This sentiment was particularly strong in Minas Gerais, and, of course, in independent-minded São Paulo. It was less so in Rio, that to some extent profited from the Portuguese policy of restricting all trade of the Portuguese Empire to Portuguese ships. It was less popular in the Northwest, Pernambuco or Salvador, that always had to dread another slave uprising, and it was least of all popular in the northeastern corner of Brazil, Ceará and Maranhão, that still dangled on subsidies from Portugal. In 1788, a group of local clerics, soldiers, a lawyer, and a shoemaker, Joaquim José da Silva Xavier, who also practices a dentist, and that in that period consisted of getting people drunk in the public market and then pulling their teeth out, hence his nickname, Tiradentes, discussed whether they might not proclaim Minas Gerais to an independent state. This conspiracy was, however, betrayed to the Portuguese crown, and all the conspirators were in the year 1789 banished to Angola, except Tiradentes, who was executed and would later on become the great symbol of Brazil's urge for independence. Yet the Portuguese colonies were by no means unique. Throughout the Atlantic colonies, there were by the 60s rumblings they would no longer permit that drain of resources towards the metropolis. Even in the North American case, after all, the British Parliament represented above all the nobilities, the traders, and the wealthy manufacturers of England, and those sought to restrict all trade and all manufacturing of the British Empire to themselves. Not surprising, Benjamin Franklin in 1763 could write, "Britain would trade and manufacture for the entire world. England would trade and manufacture for Britain. London would trade a manufacture for England, and every Londoner would trade a manufacture for other Londoners. All this caused increasing discontent in both South and North America, and we are going to deal with that issue in the next lecture.